It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Well, shoot, it's a Mississippi Sunday morning. It's a Georgia Sunday morning. It's a Northwest Florida Sunday morning. There may be some listeners over there in Louisiana, maybe up in Tennessee, and we're happy to have you as well. It sort of all revolves around all of this nice heat that the Gulf is throwing off. Where we are and what we report about. You know, I have been thinking a lot about what I tell you and whether it can be trusted. And it's always important. You should ask that question too. I was standing in the line. One of those places. And the person in front of me said, you know, I want to know if you've got the seed that grows everywhere. You know, it's a grass seed. It grows everywhere. I'm thinking to myself, don't say anything. Just don't get involved. Just hang back. Just don't even. And they have this discussion, and he says, it's from Australia. I'm thinking, what kind of grass from Australia? And I can't, and I just don't get involved, I tell myself. It's not a radio show. Life is not a radio show. Don't get involved. And it goes on, and finally he pulls out his billfold and pulls out a name. And there it is, Dichondra. And he has trouble pronouncing it, and the clerk and I, at that point, blurt out, Dichondra is not a grass. And it won't grow everywhere. And you should be really careful about people who make extravagant claims like that. And he put it back in his pocket and left. Probably he will continue to look for something that somebody told him. How do you know that what I'm telling you is true? How do you know? And I have been thinking a lot about it. We did an art show this past week. It was really cool. And it occurred to me, you know, this is not science, this is art, but is it telling me something important? I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And then, you know, it occurred to me that I wake up every morning squinting out the window, and I doubt science. And every evening, I come in, I take off my boots, and I'm looking at these clouds on fire behind me, and I doubt science. Every day. 60 years, I've been reminded by science that I am not the center of the universe, and I still can't comprehend the sun. It's plain as day to me. It's just plain as day that the sun rises every morning and declines every evening. This, you know, it's got this big giant orb moving on this clearly defined circular path just for me to illuminate my days and initiate my sleep and dreams, to define my seasons and years. It's just clear that that's the way it is. And yet, science tells us that that's not the way it is at all. That in fact, it's the earth that's doing the moving. That is causing the way that leads to the way I view the world and my days and my nights, and that the sun is stable and that we move. We revolve around the sun in ways that I still can't comprehend. I can never remember whether it's the spinning and the tilt that turns the days and the seasons, and it's complicated, and it would take a view well outside of what I'm seeing when I get up in the morning. And that's the way it is in the garden. You know, sometimes it seems so plain to us because we have this, you know, we just take these little momentary perspectives of how things work in the garden. And we say, it seems so plain to us that this is causing this. And so we figure things out, and it's not true at all. And we do things like we say, oh, man, you know, somebody, I heard somebody died of a vaccine that we don't really have any data on. We don't really, and we forget that science is there to help us. It's there to help us. And so when we think about the garden and when we think about things that happen in the garden, sometimes I can tell you out of my own experience because I've done it so often that I feel pretty good about it. And I feel pretty good about saying this happens. But a lot of times, I'll tell you frankly, I rely on people who've done science and who've looked at it over and over again and who test the way we view things. They test our perspective. They know that it seems plain to us that the sun rises and that the sun sets and that it's moving in a circular path above us. It seems that's the way it is because that's our perspective. But it becomes important to know after a while that that's not the way it is. And science can help us overcome our limited ability to see where we are and who we are and what we're doing here and how we should react to it. It's a good friend. It's a good friend because it helps us to see things. We undervalue science a lot now. We've undervalued it a lot. We've undervalued art as well. And it occurred to me that art is kind of the same way. I've been thinking about it. You know, what we like is art that confirms if we're interested in art at all. We like things that confirm what we're already seeing. So I was thinking about Southern art is about art that we've already seen, and Southern art is about magnolias. And I put together a big poster, if you will, with one image of magnolia after another. After another, after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, and none of them told me anything about magnolias that I didn't already know, or that other people, and they're designed not to make us think too much about magnolias, but the best art makes us refresh the way we think about where we are. It makes us think, gosh, maybe my own little perspective here isn't enough. Maybe there's something else out there. Art allows us in its own way to test what we're seeing. Best art, best science tests what we're doing. That's how you know what to do in the garden. It is still very hard for me to overcome the language that we developed years and years ago before we really understood the science, or when we ignored the science, is probably a better way of thinking about it. And we say, oh, plants eat fertilizer. Plants need fertilizer to eat, and plants don't need fertilizer to eat at all. Fertilizer, plants eat, they produce their own food. Plants do, and they do it because they're green and they're looking at the sun, and that seems so strange to us because we're not green and we're dependent on other things to make food for us. And the idea that plants could make almost all their own food just by sunlight, that almost all of their own food comes from sunlight, seems weird to us. And yet that's the way it is. It's important in the garden. And that means you got to think about that. It might seem that plowing makes a lot of sense because, well, people have been doing it for a long time. And what we wanted, and I can give you all the reasons, but science says, hold on, let's think about this. We'll be talking more about science on today's show and what that can tell you about where you are and how you garden.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Thinking about science, thinking about art. You know, we had this really cool exhibit that was part of what we do, and we started the Pate Rock Forest Research Center because we believe that testing our assumptions about what was going on in forests was really important. And we believe that it was really necessary to understand what was going on with forests and what's going on with agriculture. And, it's sometimes I think that we're actually trying to address the wrong things in agriculture. We sometimes ask the wrong questions. And we don't do enough testing to actually understand sometimes, how do soils work? Why do plants like growing in some places and not others? Important questions if you're doing ag, right? Important questions if you're trying to make money growing something. Important questions if you're trying to save a forest. And yet at the same time, let me tell you why science is irritating. At times, not only because it challenges us to rethink where we are, and it tests what our perceptions are about things. People don't like to be tested. People don't like to have their normal view of things tested, even if it causes them problems, even if it can be dangerous not to test those things. And I don't like having to think about, when I first wake up in the morning, that the sun is not actually rising, that I'm spinning. Because I already feel a little queasy in the morning. You know how that is. Kind of stumble around when I get out of bed. And the idea that this planet is spinning, and that's what's, and moving, spinning and moving and tilting, oh, Lord have mercy. How the heck am I supposed to envision all that? And yet that's what science makes us do. And it's good, because we've learned a whole lot from that. We've learned a whole lot about how we are, how we fit into the universe, how we're affected by things like sunspots and other things. It's good that we understand that we revolve around the sun and turn and twist at the same time. All of that's important, and yet it's hard to hear when you first wake up, but it's good. But sometimes science is annoying for another reason, and that is it can be slow. And please believe me, I appreciate more than most people how slow science can be. It can be frustrating and tedious. Sometimes we don't even have enough money to get researchers to do the testing that needs to be done, and you have to spend years coming up with the money that it needs because we undervalue science. We undervalue our ability to see things in new ways. And a lot of money that gets funded is just basically from companies, for example, that produce chemicals. And what we want is science that confirms that it's okay for them to produce those chemicals. And sometimes maybe that's not the best science in the world. You have to think about where the funding is coming from, and you have to think about the questions that are being asked, and you have to realize that the best science is always slow, and it's very tedious because it usually involves repetition, doing things over and over and over again. When people see what we're doing in the forest at Paint Rock, it blows their mind, because it's like, they say to me, are you serious that you have a tag on 89,000 trees and that you've measured every one of those trees and that you've identified every one of them? Are you serious? And until you see it, you won't believe it. It's just incredible. And yet, it gives us the kind of repetition. It gives us the kind of knowledge that we need to ask really good questions. Am I the one who asks those questions? Actually, yes. Am I the one who answers them? No. I just get to throw in a few questions here and there. It's the researchers who do it, and they're very slow, and they're very deliberate, and they're very tedious. And so sometimes science doesn't ask questions fast enough, and sometimes it doesn't answer them fast enough. And sometimes we need to react right away, and that can be frustrating. One of the cool things about art is that I think it's slow too, and it's deliberate, and the best art really requires a kind of build up in time. It's time consuming, and it's thought consuming, but it allows us to make connections we wouldn't have made otherwise. And it can't prove those connections. It can't test those connections. That's for science to do. But it can make some interesting leaps that make us ask better questions about where we are. And there's some great art that does that. I was listening to Beethoven the other day and think he did that. There's poetry that makes us do that. There's paintings that make us do that. It's good. And it's not the magnolias that we paint over and over again without really thinking about, what's going on in this flower? Why is it shaped like it is? Why does it smell like it does? Why is it pretty at all? Why do we perceive it as pretty? What do beetles do when they get inside and punch holes in these flowers? What's that all about? You know, what's the difference between a male and a female magnolia flower? That's a trick question. And it's one of those kinds of questions that the more you know about science, the more it makes you scratch your head, because it's not necessarily like the way we think about male and female and gender. It's all in one flower. Male and female both. There aren't male magnolias, and there aren't female magnolias. There are only magnolias that are both male and female. Perfect, as we would say in the world of botany. Perfect flowers. Science, you need science to help you understand that. And why would you want to know that? Because then you say, I got to have two magnolias to make seeds. Well, yes. And I got to have a How do I tell the difference between a male and a female magnolia? Well, you don't. And, you know, I got to have two tomatoes to make tomatoes. No, actually, you don't. You can have one tomato. But you may need two. Sometimes you don't need even two citrus to make citrus. How does all this work? Well, it's very different than humans are over time, and you have to understand all that, and science can help us do it. The virtues of science. When is the best time to plant kumquats? You know, kumquats, I would say, you could plant almost any time. They're very hardy, kumquats are. They're not too vulnerable going into winter. I guess you could have, if you planted them now, We could have a really freak weird winter where the kumquat could be damaged, but I doubt it. Not, at least particularly not on the Gulf Coast, where it's easy to grow kumquats. As you move farther north, the season in which you plant kumquats becomes more important. I think if you were to plant a kumquat in, say, Montgomery, where kumquats are on the edge of their tolerance, or in Birmingham, you would definitely want to plant those kumquats in spring so that they get really well established before fall gets here and before the first cold of winter gets here. Probably doesn't matter that much if you're living in Mobile. Don't do it in the middle of winter, though.
Well, I can't hunt and I can't fish, but I can drive you crazy, yes I can. Well, I can't even make a dish, but I can drive you crazy, yes I can.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We could talk about a lot of things. You know, one of the things that's hard to appreciate is that when the days are still hot, that's when you plant cool season vegetables. And it doesn't seem, it's like the craziness of thinking about when you first get up in the morning, you have to think about, oh man, the sun is not revolving around my day. I'm revolving around the sun. I'm spinning. I'm tilting all at once. Oh, and it makes you queasy to think about all that when you first wake up. But you know, this heat, you gotta ignore it. And because we have plenty of experience now. And it's a kind of science. It's a kind of repetition in which people have... We've compared notes, lots of people, and their experience is the same. And that becomes a kind of science. It's not just one person's experience. It's lots of people's experience. And you can compare and you can say, well, I'm not sure that person did it quite right or thought about it quite right. You can make those kinds of judgments after you evaluate carefully. But over years, we've discovered that, and it's pretty obvious in a way, that you've got to get your plants in early if you're going to get them to grow in time for winter. And we also have learned that the experience of people in Minnesota should not be the same as the experience of people in Alabama when it comes to planting gardens. Ooh, that's been a hard one. And it still is a hard one. And it's becoming harder because we've all been taught that, you know, whatever you read on the internet is true everywhere, and it isn't true everywhere. It may not even be true anywhere, to be honest. You have to be thoughtful about that. You have to be careful. This is the time, folks. Let me just say, this is the time when you need to get your stuff out. I feel like I'm so tentative all these first planting out these first cool season vegetables. I've raised them from seed. I've got cabbages. I've got collards. I've got kale coming, I've got parsley, I've got a whole series of things, and old perpetual chard. It's just so much fun, and yet putting these first little plants out, it gets spooky. It's scary. But I have to remember, you know, I've done this before. Here are the ways to deal with it. Here are the ways to protect it. You can talk to me about it. You can give me a call. We'll talk about how I'm planting those things. And we're going to talk a good bit about science this morning and about how we know what we know and what are the kind of questions we ought to be asking. It's kind of a fun thing. My persimmons are almost ready, Johnny says. I want to net the tree to protect the fruit. I'm afraid if I put the net on too early that I'll kill the tree. Any advice, Johnny at Grand Bay? A couple of thoughts. One of the things about persimmons is that, just two thoughts, as those persimmon fruits mature, they are a little bit like, they're not like figs, they're more like tomatoes. And that is, you can pick them when they begin to turn color and leave them sit inside until they fully ripen. And they're okay. And they do well, and they still taste very well. And when I had a problem with birds, I learned that before the fruits were full well soft, there was a certain time when I could pick them and bring them inside. That's one way to think about it. And I almost never let persimmons get fully soft on the tree anymore. Even the astringent persimmons. Because, well, it's by the time they're soft, when you pick them, they fall apart in your hands. And it really got to be really hard to judge. So you pick them a little early. And that's one way to avoid it. The second way, and rather than netting the whole tree, Johnny, one of the things I might do, because you don't have that many fruits, I might have thinned a few on that young tree, by the way, but that's another story, is if they are astringent persimmons, that is the ones that retain a lot of tannins and mouth puckering ability right up until they get really soft ripe, then what you can do is you can take, gosh, what do you call, organza. Is that what they call that stuff? Organza bags, which a lot of us have done. They use them for weddings, and they use them, and they're not that expensive, and you can just cover them with the little organza bags. They even have little ties, and that protects the fruit pretty well. The birds aren't going to peck through that. And you don't have to cover the whole tree. And you can reuse the organza bags forever. I mean, they last way too long, I expect. So you can use those organza bags. The third thing is, Johnny, and this gets a little complicated, is I've got to figure out whether you have an astringent or a non-astringent persimmon. Do you remember what variety of it is? If it's a non-astringent persimmon, that means you can eat it while it's still hard. And the fact is, it may not be, it's as good as, it's about as good hard as it is soft. The astringent persimmons are better. The ones that stay astringent, they're going to always be better. But the non-astringent persimmons are fine, and they have a good taste and a good flavor, almost pumpkin-like, not too sweet. And they're great for cooking and other things. Those kind of persimmons, I don't see you'll have a lot of problems. You should not have a lot of problems with birds. Because you can pick them early before they get soft. You could have a problem with squirrels, but the bag will help if you have a problem with squirrels. Does that help you, Johnny? And let me know. You can send me a text, and we can, if you know what kind of persimmon you have, it can be useful for me to look it up to see whether it's astringent or non-astringent. The fruits are looking a little not astringent, but I can't quite tell. So you'll have to, if you can give me a little bit more information about those fruits. Boy, the persimmons are coming on. They're going to be, you know, some persimmons have already begun ripening, and that's really neat. In September, with our long seasons here in Alabama, we'll begin to see ripening of a lot of persimmons, and that can continue even for some trees. That same tree could continue ripening fruit through the 1st of December. It's amazing. I love persimmons. They're great. They're a wonderful thing to have. And what Johnny has is an Asian persimmon, not a native persimmon. But the native persimmons are really good, too. And it's a lot harder to protect the fruit. It's just that they produce so many that you kind of can stand to compete with the birds and the squirrels and everybody else. Really cool things, persimmons. One of the things we're doing more research on is persimmons. And, you know, UltraRunner asked me, what kind of questions are we asking? And there's some really big questions, and then there are some smaller questions. One of the smaller questions is really about persimmons. Alabama we've never developed our persimmons in the way, say, Asian countries have developed their persimmons, China and Japan. Japan is famous for it, but China's done a great job as well. There's a lot of other countries that have developed great. Korean persimmons are wonderful. Some are well adapted to South Alabama. Some aren't. Some are better adapted to North Alabama. They're really cool persimmons. And we've got all these native persimmons. And they develop their own, and we import them, but we don't develop our own persimmon. Why not? I actually think that our native persimmons actually have better flavor. They're just a little harder to manage, and there's nothing wrong with the flavor of Asian persimmons. Don't get me wrong. It's just that our native persimmons are so good, but we've done very little to select them, at least since those who came after Columbus, those who just got off the boat with Columbus. We haven't done much with those persimmons. Michigan is beginning to think about persimmons. But you know, here's the truth. Michigan doesn't have a lot of persimmon diversity. They barely even rank where persimmons are concerned. Whereas in Alabama, we got persimmons everywhere. Native persimmons everywhere. So, why haven't we developed ours? And that's one of the questions we're asking. On our forest plot, we've got so many different persimmons. We actually are going to look at the DNA of most of the persimmons on our plot. That could be hundreds of persimmons. And we're going to look at what are the differences between these individuals. That will not be a cheap thing to do. And we'll say, what is the difference between these individuals? And are there qualities in these persimmons that we should develop to make them better fruits and easier fruits to manage? Cool thing, huh? Here's the other fun thing. We're actually going to look because we believe that people have been in Alabama long before Columbus got here. Believe it or not. Long before most of our great grandparents got here, and people have been here for a long time. And we think that before 1500, there was a lot of effort to develop really good persimmons. And we think there's some evidence of that in the forest, because there's some persimmons that we're looking at that the fruits are gigantic. They're really huge compared to other persimmons. That the amount of pulp compared to seed is really high. And we know, in many cases, these persimmons are near places where we have lots of evidence of the people who were here before Columbus. They may be art. They may have art on the walls. And that's really cool. They may have art in the caves. We may have evidence of their tools. We may have evidence. And why wouldn't they be selecting for persimmons with larger fruit? So that's one of the cool things, is we're going to be looking to see if we can see the impact of human selection. And does that help us? Their efforts before we drove them off out of the United States to other states or to Mexico. What did they do for persimmons that we can learn from? It's borrowing from the past. It's a really cool thing with persimmons. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the other things we're doing and some of the other questions we're asking. They're much bigger.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, so great question, Ultra Runner. So we got to talk about some of the things we're doing at the Research Center, looking at trees and looking at trees that have too long been undervalued in a state that is the center. Listen, it's the center of tree diversity in the United States. Alabama. Gee Willie. How does that happen? And how many trees can you name? You know, I'll make it simple. Just name a pine. We have 8 of them that are native, maybe 9. And what do you think? What do you think? What, can you name them? We really don't have a lot of good sense about what our trees are and what their value is. We have 40 species of oaks. Gosh, I can't remember how many ash trees did we have? Something like 7, 8 species of ash. We have 75% of the world's hickory species here in Alabama. 75% of the world's hickory species. We're the center of hickory diversity globally. It goes on and on. But persimmons are pretty cool. And I think we have one of the important things to understand about the South, and one of the things we're working on, is that not only do we have a lot of species, in 150 acres, we're getting pretty close to 100 species of trees. And that's pretty phenomenal. That's almost as much as you might see in a subtropical forest, where you would expect more trees. And a tropical forest of that size may have 300 species of trees. And so one of the questions we like to ask is, why? Why would you have so much diversity? And please believe me, that's a really important question. Why was it important to have a richness of species, if you like those terms? Why is it so important? And it probably, I could argue that it is less important in a place like Minnesota than it is in a place like Alabama. And we're beginning to see the effects of saying, oh, well, having one species of pine is good enough. We can't think of 8 species of pine. We can only think of one species of pine at a time. That's fine. We'll settle for that. And it's costing us. It's a huge issue. We're losing as a result. We're getting behind. It's a big problem. But we got a lot of species of trees. And so one of the cool things is that we can look at species like persimmons, and we can say not only do we have a large richness of species, but we have a large richness of genes within those species like persimmons, and we can go back to those persimmons. We have more genes. Our persimmons have greater gene richness, if you will, more variation between each individual in genes, and maybe even sometimes more genes packed into each individual, than trees farther north. And there's a good reason for that. It has to do with this thing that we used to could talk about that we call climate. It changes. It has changed. You believe in that change because you believe in ice ages. Right? It happens. And because of that, we ended up, because of all those climate changes, we were more stable. And we ended up with more gene richness. And that's really important. And within persimmons, we have this huge gene richness that we've never really developed here because we never really had a lot of... We never thought we were special. We always thought, well, it's Alabama. It's a great place to raise the kids. It's a good place to build a house. And we never said, gosh, we're really special. Not because of who we are as people, but because the place is really special. Now, if we as people ever realize that the place was special, we might be special too. But we haven't done that. So we're looking at things like persimmons now because we think the place is special. And we think it's important, and we think that we might have the genetics for a new kind of persimmon. Isn't that cool? Can we use DNA analysis to do a better job of selecting trees? Yes, I think we can. And that is because we can select for fruit quality sometimes without selecting for loss of other alleles. Alleles are those little points on the chromosome that do other things, that do a variety of things in a plant. And sometimes we are too restrictive in the kind of things we select for, and we reduce the richness within the plant and its ability to adapt. And yes, I think we can. And that will be one of the goals, is to understand, is to use persimmons that have a lot of richness in the first place and select from those without compromising that plant's ability to adapt. Selection always compromises a plant's ability to adapt. It's why we have so many problems with so many fruit trees now. From citrus to bananas to apples. It's one of the long-standing problems of cultivation, is that we lose a plant's ability to adapt. How do we preserve that? Tomatoes, my goodness, goodness gracious, you want to know why you have so many problems with tomatoes? It's because we've deselected their ability to adapt. We've deselected their ability to deal with diseases and pests. Huh. How do we do that? Yeah, I think that's one of the things that will help us. Dave from Gulf Shores, I thought persimmons were from China. I was born in Seoul. I learned about persimmons there. Could you fill in the link between there and here on the persimmons? Thank you very much, and I enjoy the show. It is a very interesting thing. What is the link between China and South Korea and North Korea and Japan and the southeastern United States? And one of the things in this forest is that we can go through and we can see, oh, trilliums. Trilliums only exist in China and Japan. I think they exist in Japan. Yes, I think they do. And the Koreas. And in the southeastern United States? What in the world? How did that happen? Hickories. Only in the southeastern United States and only in China. What in the world is going on? There's lots of plants like that. What's going on? It's because of climate change. And it's because of ancient climate changes that when the oaks and hickories and many other things, they were at the top of the world. Many, many millennia ago, 50,000, 60,000, well, yeah, 50, 60,000 years ago, they were at the top of the world. And that's where they developed. And oaks might have begun to develop, losing their leaves, in part because the days were so short at the top of the world. We'll come back. Oh, boy, that's a long discussion. But we're coming back. We're going to talk about that. Thanks for asking that, Dave.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Diospyros. Persimmons, that's where this conversation has evolved to. Good subject. We were talking about the kind of research we're doing and looking at why haven't we developed our Native American persimmons. There's 700 persimmons in the world. 700 or so species of persimmons. Quite a lot, a few of them are in Asia. About 100 of those species are in the Americas. I think they're a little more common in the Eastern Hemisphere rather than in the Western Hemisphere, but the Western Hemisphere has got a lot. North America has, I want to think, 2-3 species, maybe a few more. So most Diospyros are tropical. There were connections between the globe, across the globe, during other earlier climate regimes. And at one point, species could move across in many ways. And I think particularly for the flowering species of trees, that movement tended to occur, oh, you don't care, between 70 and 50 million years ago, 30 to 70 million years ago is my guess. And it moved across places like the Arctic, which in those days was actually a relatively warm place with very, very long summer days and very almost non-existent winter days, which created some problems for plants, and so they learned to be deciduous under those conditions, just as they learned to be deciduous under dry conditions. Losing leaves is an interesting phenomenon that has to do not just with being cold, but with a lot of other things. Important to know if you're thinking about plants and why they are like they are and what you're going to do about them. So there were persimmons in both hemispheres. And in Korea and in China and in Japan, there was a lot of development of those persimmon species, but very little development here in North America, at least after Columbus came. We think there might have been a good bit of development before Columbus came, as there was with many plants in North America. People who were smarter than us, because they looked at where they are and said, how are we going to make the best of this? We still haven't done that. Great opportunities for persimmons in North America. So we have the Native American persimmon, what we call the American persimmon. There are actually a few others, in Texas and in Arizona, and but Western persimmons are a little different, and there are a few more species out there. I can't remember exactly how many, forgive me. And as you move into Central and South America, you find a lot of persimmons as well. Some of them are edible, and some of them really aren't, at least by people. But it's a big group of plants, persimmons, across the globe. We just haven't done much with ours. Johnny asked why, you know, his native persimmons did not do as well this year as in previous years. And it can be affected by a lot of things. I mean, there is, even all things being equal, even things like satsumas have good years and bad years, regardless of whether there was a massive frost as there was in Johnny's garden that kind of meant he didn't have any. Well, it certainly reduced his persimmons this year. And a lot of trees have good years and bad years in part because they get exhausted. It's a lot of effort producing fruit. Not as much effort to produce flowers, not as much effort to produce just leaves, but producing fruit, it's a big deal. And it takes a lot of energy, and things need to be kind of good. And so a lot of trees, for a variety of reasons, another thing we're trying to research, have good years and bad years when it comes to fruit. Things to think about. We're talking about how to protect those fruits. And let me go back again real quickly. If you've got Asian persimmons that are astringent, that is, they keep those mouth-puckering tannins until the fruit's fully ripe, and the seeds are fully developed, you can understand why they might have done that. If you think about it, that's probably an ancient genetic trick that the persimmons had to keep wildlife from eating the fruit before it was fully ripe and before the seeds were ready. But you can overcome that by being smart and understanding that there are astringent persimmons, and if you pick them while they're turning colors, but before they get soft, you can let them ripen inside, or you can just let them ripen on the tree if you don't have a problem with birds or squirrels or other competition for those very delicious fruits. One of our great, you know, this has been our big missing thing. If I had to, the fruit with the richest flavor, and I like apples, and I love figs, and I like pears, and I love satsumas, and all the citrus. There's so many cool ones. I love blueberries. I think they're just wonderful. But, man, if I had to pick a fruit that had just incredible richness in flavors and the most potential for development of really great, delicious flavors. And I mean, things like coconut and plum and, you know, mango, all of these different flavors that I can taste in the native persimmons. They're really rich. Really rich. And other things, caramel. Oh, there's just an incredible variety of flavors in there. And we barely touched it for developing it as a fruit. Isn't that a shame? A lot of research we can do, a lot of science that needs to be done that would make our lives better if we understood how important that science is and if we were willing to fund it. And right now, we've cut the funding for most of those programs. They weren't costing us that much at all. You know, it'll be another generation now. But we're doing our best to advance in a time when science isn't being funded, and in many ways it's being silenced. Great things open. You know, some other great questions we're asking is why are trees where they are? And it's quite obvious to us, and it was sort of obvious that some trees were only growing in certain places in the Alabama forest and not in other places. It's one of the reasons why we chose the forest we did to study, is because it was rich in species that were only growing in some places and not in other places. And we wanted to be able to answer that question. It's not like the same tree grew everywhere. I mean, we want that to be the case. It's funny, we have a lot of garden centers and other places, and you know, they assume that the same tree will grow everywhere, and so they have things like, they want to have an arboretum, and one of the things that it was suggested at Mobile Botanical Gardens at one point was to have an old-style arboretum where you brought in trees from everywhere and just planted them and let them all grow together, which was going to be a disaster. And the fact of the matter is that site was so particular and so unusual that it was clearly not going to be able to support trees from many different places. Why do trees grow where they grow? Why doesn't every tree grow everywhere? That's a really interesting question, don't you think? Wouldn't you want to know that before you planted a tree in your yard? That's the kind of thing we're thinking about. We'll come back and talk about it. Blue Deckhound dog getting, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio plays.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Do trees grow everywhere? No. We would like for that to be the case, and it causes us lots of grief and problems. And one of the problems is, for example, sky pencil hollies dying gradually. That's from Nicole in Fairhope. Our phone system isn't working quite the way it should. And so she can't actually talk to us directly. We'll have that fixed by next week. Sorry about that. But I will say that the Japanese group of hollies that has been developed in the trade was developed for mild climates with fewer diseases. And when you plant those hollies, like sky pencil, in a place like Alabama, you're going to get all kinds of problems, particularly in South Alabama, you're going to get all kinds of problems with root rots, and that's probably an issue because there's a lot of moisture here that those plants can't deal with. And they're just not going to perform well. So I suspect it's a root rot is at the core of it. It could be a stem problem as well. We don't have pictures of that. You can text me pictures, but it's probably kind of beside the point because just generally there's so many things that can go wrong with those Japanese hollies. And it is because Home Depot and Lowe's and Walmart and all the other places you're buying from like to preserve the illusion that the same plant grows everywhere equally well. And it doesn't. And so it's really nice to know where you are and to know what grows well where you are. And it's not something we've done really well on. So we end up with these Asian hollies that don't do well. If we had maybe even selected some Asian hollies from South Japan or from Okinawa or from the Ryukyu Islands or from South China, they may have done better, but instead we selected from places where they're kind of naive to some of the diseases that we have and they're very susceptible. And then we develop them for northern climates like New Jersey and they just don't do well here. Period. I would begin looking for ways to not preserve those sky pencils, but to find something that would be a good replacement for them. Because if it's not this, it'll be that. If it's not one disease, it'll be another. They are short-lived here. They have a real problem. So one of the cool things is we're thinking about in this forest is even with a small, relatively small area, like 150 acres, which is, I forgot how many football fields, but maybe close to 100 football fields, something like that. Even in a forest like that, 112 football fields, something. But it's not a huge area. It's a big area, but not a huge area. Where do plants grow? And you'd think things like beech would grow, well, they must grow all over. Well, they don't grow all over. And you'd think things like maples, well, they must grow all, but they don't grow all over. And you think things like magnolias, well, maybe they're even, but they're not. They're in these little thin little bands. It's weird. It's like little trails of trees, and it's like one tree following another across a band. And then they'll be in another place, and there'll be a band. And some of that may have to do with where seed falls, but then it's in these little narrow bands. It's not like in some kind of circle of things that's expanding. What in the world is going on? We're not sure. But it's clearly not the things we usually say. It's not where the seed falls. That's part of it, but it's not the main thing. It's not where the moisture is. Because we see this happening in places where the moisture is the same. But there's different trees that are only growing one place and not in another. Is it just some weird artifact of humans? No, it doesn't seem to be. So one of the things we're trying to understand is, for example, what is driving where these trees are? Because if we're going to say, oh, we want to preserve this forest and we want to make sure that it has a potential to spread into other areas for many reasons, because forests have been destroyed in other areas, they've been wiped out, and so we would like to recreate a forest there that is rich, again, that is once again Alabama rich. Or maybe we see that, in fact, trees are dying farther north, like elms are dying and ash are dying farther north, and because those trees don't have the genetic basis to deal with diseases. And so we know that their forests will need to be supplied by our forests. But we know that now that because of what we've seen in our forests, we know that those trees won't just grow anywhere and everywhere. We have to understand why they grow where they grow before we start moving around. So many reasons. And what if it's the soil? What if it is not just the chemistry of the soil, but what if is the fact that there are 10,000 creatures? 10,000 creatures in the soil in our forest, in our research forest, just in our little research forest. 10,000 creatures in the soil you don't even know the names of. We don't even have names for most of them. As Ed Wilson would say, 80% of the species in the world we don't know, and these are one of the great gaps we have in our knowledge. And they're all affecting things above ground in dramatic ways. And you know how much we've studied that? It's embarrassing. It probably is the biggest determinant in agriculture, one of the biggest factors in agriculture. It's certainly one of the biggest determinants in why your sky pencil isn't growing the way it's growing. Isn't growing the way you hoped it would. It's because we barely understand those things. And we know that there are pathogens in the soil. We know there are things like Pythium and Phytophthora. Phytophthora is a great name. Phyto, plant. Thora, killer, the plant murderer, Phytophthora, really potent disease, really affects a lot of things around you every day, and you barely know about it. And so we're trying to figure out, and then there are beneficial things in the soils, and then there are things that make it really easy for the non-beneficial things like Phytophthora to enter a plant, like nematodes. Who talks about nematodes? Oh, we should be talking about them all the time. It's a huge impact on your garden. It's a huge impact on your... So we're trying to figure out all these things out. And how do you even decipher tens of thousands of things reacting together? It's hard. But that's one of the things we want to know. It's something we have to know. And yes, those pathogens continue to develop and evolve even as the plants we plant in our yards are frozen in time by selection, so they can't adapt. We can get into why. And that's a big issue, so we've got to think about that. That's part of the research we're doing. It's kind of cool. Yeah, it's the Red Queen Ultra Runner that we have to think about. Pathogens driving diversity is one of the great ways of thinking about that. David Hubble sent me a great picture of food. What a fun thing to talk about. We had a great conversation last week. Lots of things that I wanted to follow up on. But persimmon is a great way to begin to follow up on that discussion. Another of our great native plants that we've totally ignored because we don't think of Alabama as special. We don't think it holds special things. And it is. It does.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Question from Thomas that I haven't answered apparently before. When is the best time to cut and transplant Confederate roses? And I'm interpreting that to mean, well, Confederate rose, let's start there. Confederate rose is not a rose. The Confederacy it refers to is probably the Malaysian Confederacy, as nearly as I could tell. It's an Asian hibiscus. It's a hibiscus from China that probably was introduced, I think it was pretty clearly introduced to the U.S. through Indonesia, and there it is, and we think of it as native. It's not quite, and it's not a rose, it's a hibiscus. Hibiscus, some of the hibiscus can be very easy to propagate, some can be a little trickier. I think Hibiscus mutabilis, which is this Malaysian hibiscus that we call Confederate rose, is probably going to be one of the easier ones to propagate because it's been spread around for a long time. It's popular. It was popular because it was easy to propagate and you couldn't screw up very easily. If you did it in spring and summer, that's good. When you're putting on new growth and you take some 6-inch cuttings, 6 to 8 inch cuttings, and you leave a couple of nodes and you bury the node where the leaf is. You maybe strip off the leaf there and you put it in soil that's moist and put it in not too sunny a place, a little bit of sun, not too much, and it's gonna root. You'll have to water it, put it in good soil. Spring and summer's fine, but you know, you could probably do it in winter too. And you could take cuttings this time of year, even this time of year, and put it on the eastern side of your house in a somewhat shady place and bury those stems lengthwise. Not too long because you don't want it to be too hard to handle. And with a little bit of the stem sticking up, not too deep. You might want a few more nodes than you would if you did it in spring and summer. And just lay a bunch of them in there. Don't make it too hard. And even if you lose those leaves over winter, there's probably a very good chance that it'll root. And you can dig it up and move it in the spring. It's an easy one. It's an easy one, and there's lots of ways to do it. It's good when you have nice organic soil to do it in. It's not going to do in really rough soil. It's not going to do as well. And it's not going to do in really dry soil either. You'll need to keep it moist, but not sopping wet. I think that's what you mean by cutting it back. I mean, you're talking about cutting, right? To take cuttings that you use for propagation. If you had another question, let me know. I'm interpreting that. B Dark is sending me a beautiful picture of her. Get ready for this, B Dark. Write it down. Datura. Or actually, no, let's go back. Let's call it Brugmansia. Write it down. Brugmansia. Oh, Brugmansia. Brugman, I guess, was the guy it was named for. Brugmansia. It has a common name of angel's trumpets, and there are other plants called angel's trumpets which can get you confused. But this one is, let's just call this one angel's trumpets for lack of a better term, too. And Be Dark, as always, you can give it your own name, and you should. It's a really cool plant, isn't it? Brugmansia. It's in the group of plants. It's in the Datura group, and it's related to things like Jimson weed. If you know Jimson weed, Jamestown weed, Loco weed, it is Brugmansia. A little bit toxic if you were to eat it. Wouldn't do it. Wouldn't recommend it. But it's got beautiful flowers, and there's some really cool ones out there, and you got a nice one. It too is relatively easy to propagate. Just throw those stems in the ground and they'll root pretty readily. That's one of the reasons it gets spread around. David B. says, how do you do the genetic testing? This is, well, I'm so glad. You know, it's like I'm getting these really fun questions today. We do genetic testing on plants. And we're trying to find funds to do more and really increase our genetic testing because it's important to know the difference between individuals. We don't even have a lot of respect for species in Alabama, even though we're the center of species richness in many ways in North America. You know, we're the center of aquatic diversity, and we can only name one fish, a largemouth bass. It's crazy. It's insane. You know, it's insane. Gee. But here's the thing. It's not just species. It's the individuals in Alabama that matter. Isn't that wild? That it makes a difference when you're thinking about the future of oak species. It's good to know the difference between individual oaks. And that's going to make not just one live oak, but what's the difference between all those live oaks? Now, live oaks are... We're going to create problems for our live oaks, and I've said this over and over again, by planting them the way we are, and we've actually selected so that we have less diversity within those live oaks, and we will continue to ensure that we are creating disease problems for our live oaks because they're not really well adapted to being planted row after row after row the way we've done. But here's the thing. We do think individuals will matter. And some individuals are going to be better at surviving diseases and pathogens than others, and we'll be looking for those. How do we do it? That's the cool part. So we have to do this in order to understand what is the DNA of a tree. It's not like we draw blood from the tree. We actually take leaves when they're very young. And they have to be very young. It has to be before the bugs have started eating on them. I am learning. There are people at this much smarter than I am. And they're telling me, we want to do it before the bugs have started eating on the leaves. Because once the bugs have started eating on the leaves, it changes the chemical composition of the leaves and it makes it harder to read the DNA. And so we take those very young leaves. We do it, have a very narrow window in spring when they're just emerging. And then we immediately put them in liquid nitrogen. In a capsule and put that capsule in liquid nitrogen to freeze them so that it sort of freezes them where they are at super cold temperatures. We have a little canister that's really steamy when you take it out in the woods. It's quite an elaborate operation. And then we hold those and we freeze them until we can run them through these very elaborate processors at the Hudson Alpha Institute in Huntsville, which is really one of the nation's, probably the nation's top genetic research institute for plants. Another thing we don't think about is how important research is to Alabama and how many jobs it provides. And so they're doing great work on that, and it's really cool. That's how we do it. And once we've identified potentially promising things, we can certainly graft those. We can certainly use tissue culture to propagate those. But, you know, it's important, and one of the things we're emphasizing is it's important to think not just about preserving one individual, but preserving multiple individuals with certain characteristics so that they have the ability to adapt, so that the Red Queen doesn't trap us, as Ultra Runner would say. We want those plants to be able to adapt with time to the increase in pathogens, and we never know what pathogens are going to materialize, so we don't want to restrict too much each plant. And that's going to require a new way of thinking about how we, what a cultivar is. Oh, another subject. It's a good one, though, David. It's a good one. It's a good one. Paul, I'm listening. What's up? Paul, you there? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Paul is there, but Paul could not ask the question because he, I am so sorry. So he said, when is the right time to transplant hostas? You know, it would almost inevitably be late fall, right? Almost inevitably be late fall in southern Georgia, and in there aren't many hostas that will do well, and only a very few. And you definitely they're so stressed by summer here, even the best ones. And so you definitely don't want to do it in spring because summer comes too quickly after spring. The best time to transplant those is going to be late-ish fall. I would wait until October, and I think by late October you'll be fine. You'll have to water them pretty good, but then winter will take care of it. And in America, oh, you could do it in mid-October. But that would be the ideal time. I would not wait until spring to do it. I think it's the wrong time to do it. These two are growing in the gravel parking lot where I work downtown. I'm going to try to... Are they invasive? So, Sisembrifolia, one of those plants is a tomato relative. It is a little bit invasive. I can't remember what the common name is. The Latin name is Solanum Sisembrifolia, something like that. Does it produce edible fruit? Yes, I think it does. And my good friend, I had a good friend who was propagating this plant. It's a very thorny, difficult little guy, but it is a tomato relative. Solanum sisembrifolia is what I believe. I'm pretty sure it is. You can let us look at the fruits. But tomato relative Solanum, S-O-L-A-N-U-M, which is the name for all tomatoes, basically, and eggplants and lots of other things. And Sisembrifolia, am I going to find that in my head? S-I-S-Y-M-B-R-I-F-O-L-I-U-M. If I got one of those vowels wrong, don't condemn me. Solanum sisembrifolia is that big leaf thing. All right. Does that help? Good. Oh, B-Dark's loving that king squash. It is really good. We had it last night. It is so good. She's got it on the grill. Look at that. It's beautiful. That is beautiful, B-Dark.
How the weather in the country? How the weather down south? How the weather in the Delta? How the food tastes in your mouth?
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Boy, B-Dark, that just makes me hungry. And it looks really good. Those squash are delicious, aren't they? They're just really good. Kinkai squash, they're Korean squash, David. That Korea developed because we in the South didn't have the good sense to develop one of our own squashes. It's amazing. You know, this squash from the Americas, which the Koreans have developed into really great plants, Kinkai. David, if you ever know enough Korean to pronounce that for us, you'll do it. it is a great squash, and it does really well for us. And you think, gosh, why do Korean squash do so well here in the Southeast? Well, it's because those plants were selected from Central American and American, essentially American squash that do well in tropical environments like we have here in Alabama. And they were part of our history before Columbus came, the history we forgot about and ignored, and we're now trying to rebuild. That's one of the reasons we do this show, is rebuilding the sense of, gosh, we live in a special place. It's pretty cool. It's got some neat stuff. The rest of the world knows that better than we do. Isn't that amazing? But what a great squash. Isn't that a great squash? I don't want to go on too much about squash. I want to get back to that skyline. What do you call it? Sky pencil. Holly. And I feel bad because I just basically said, look, find something else. Because that Holly is going to have problems. And you can look it up. There are black rot fungus, Phytophthora fungus. There's a whole series of things that affect Ilex crenata, which is one of the most common, what we call boxwoods in the South, are mostly ilex. They're mostly hollies. They don't produce berries. They weren't selected to produce berries. They were selected from a plant called Ilex crenata, and Ilex crenata has a ton of problems. I'm not sure why Ilex crenata has so many problems. There are other hollies, like Ilex cornuta, that don't have those problems, or that have it much less often. And even our native hollies are really good. So when you have things like Yopon hollies, they can be really great and really cool. But there are several reasons. I don't know why it has so many root rot problems, but it does. That's the first problem. And that causes tons of above ground problems. Because if you haven't got any roots, you don't have any way to absorb moisture. You don't have any really good ways to have grease for the wheels, which is what you absorb from the plants, absorb from the soil, grease for the wheels, things like nitrogen. And so their photosynthesis declines and the twigs decline and they all start dying back and you have all kind of problems. But that's not the end of the problem with plants like Skyline or Sky Pencil, because Sky Pencil is very narrow and close and tightly wound in, and in a humid climate, do you know what that does? Can you imagine what that does? It means that you have lots of foliar diseases as well, like Phytophthora. And those foliar diseases also cause the plant to decline. So will we ever have a plant? You know, I do think that those kind of sky pencil shaped things, they are kind of weird and cool looking, and it kind of thinks, oh man, this is sort of our ultimate domination of nature, is that we can create these monster pencils. But you know what? Nature's going to bite you, because they don't do well here. And I don't think you'll ever find anything in quite that shape that it actually is going to do well here. Yep. So just think about that. Think about that too. It's not just the fact that it's a bad plant. It's a badly shaped plant. It's not just bad genes, it's bad shape. Well, and the shape is part of the genes, but not a good plant. Not a good plant. There we go. So we've been talking about what is the virtue of science. And science is a particular way of testing to make sure that what we're seeing is not just the result of our squinty-eyed way of looking at things. And so science helped us to understand that in spite of the fact that when we wake up in the morning we think the sun is rising, because we have a limited vision and because we can only see so far and because we're not really individually omniscient, can't see everything at once, Science has taught us that, in fact, the sun isn't rising. In fact, the earth is rotating, and it's revolving, and it's tilting. And all of those things that the earth is doing, sun's out there just kind of minding its own business. It's revolving in its own way through space. It's moving in its own way through space. But that, too, is kind of, but not in the way we perceive. And that is not how our days are measured. Not by the sun's movement. Our days are measured by the earth's movement. And science taught us that. It wasn't the obvious way to see things. It wasn't just plain as day. Well, it's plain as day. You know, I feel like that when I wake up and it's plain as day. But science says, let's test that. Let's make sure what we think we see is what we're really seeing. And good science does that. And that's why we need good science. And that's why we need more science out there to help us understand how to live. How to live better. How to live as things change around us, which they are doing. How to live as diseases become more aggressive. And believe me, they are. Not just plant diseases, but human diseases. Oh, you better have the science, folks. You better have the science, or you're in trouble. And that science isn't about somebody coming in and saying, oh, you know, I think this is so. I feel like this ought to be so. It's not just about one person having an idea. It's about many people testing and testing each other's testing. That's how science works. Is there bad science? Yeah. Is there bad art? Yeah. Is there good science? Yeah. We better figure out how to make really good science and think about it. And not just science that reflects our own prejudices. And not just science that reflects the way we feel when we get up in the morning. Testing the testing. We'll be back next week. Thanks.
And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to music?